Chapter 9. Schindler's List. Schindler's 36th birthday, the 28th of April, 1944, was a quiet day without celebrations either in the office or on the factory floor. Although Oscar did receive good wishes from his wife in Zwittau and gifts from both Ingrid and Victoria, Oscar was not in a party mood because he was upset about the war news. The Russian armies had come to a stop instead of continuing south into the German territories. Was he hoping for a German defeat without considering what that would mean to his factory and subcamp? At the same time, the possibility that the Russians might reach Poland was making life more complicated for Amon Goethe. The Nazis did not want their enemies to find any evidence of what they were doing to the Jews. So the SS had been ordered to destroy the gas chambers and crematoria at many of the death camps. The huge camp at Auschwitz would finish the job, and then the Nazis planned to destroy that as well. Plaschow had never had a gas chamber or crematorium, but its dead lay everywhere around it, and now Goethe was ordered to find and burn them. Estimates of the number of bodies at Plaschow vary widely, with some as high as 80,000. Most victims had been shot or hanged, or had died from disease. Oscar saw and smelled the piles of burning flesh and bones on the hill above the workshops during a visit to Plaschow just before his birthday. He walked into the administration office and found Itzhak Stern. Instead of making his usual polite conversation, he whispered, "Stern, what does everyone think?"
"Herr Schindler, prisoners are prisoners. They do their work and hope to survive to see another day."
"I'm going to get you all out," Oscar said as he banged on Stern's desk with his fist.
"All?"
asked Itzhak Stern. He knew that such promises could not match the reality of the situation.
"You, anyhow," said Oscar. "You."
As he left Stern's office, Oscar was depressed to see the ordinary life of the camp going on as the air filled with the thick smoke and terrible smell of burning bodies. Of course, many people began to wonder how long their ordinary life in Plaschow could continue. One of these was Mitek Pemper, a studious young prisoner who worked in the administration office beside Amon Goethe's private secretary, a young German woman called Frau Kochmann. Pemper was not supposed to see any secret Nazi documents or to read any important orders from Nazi headquarters, but because he was a much more skillful secretary than Frau Kochmann, he eventually saw almost everything that came to the office. Besides being an expert typist, Pemper also had a photographic memory, and he stored the details of beatings, hangings, and mass murders in his head without needing to write any of the information down. He knew that this was his death sentence. He was a witness that Commandant Goethe would, in the end, have to get rid of. At the end of April, Pemper read a letter from Berlin that he would always remember. A labor chief was asking Goethe how many Hungarian Jewish prisoners could be held temporarily at Plaschow, while a weapons factory at Auschwitz prepared itself to receive them. The Labour Department would be very grateful if Goethe could take as many as 7,000 of these recent, relatively healthy prisoners. Goethe's answer, either seen or typed by Pemper, stated that there was no room at Plaschow, but he would be happy to accept 10,000 prisoners on their way to Auschwitz if he were given permission to get rid of the unproductive prisoners inside the camp. Goethe was later pleased to receive notice that the director of the gas chambers at Auschwitz-Birkenau would expect a group of unfit prisoners to be delivered from Plaschow, and that transport would be arranged from the gate of his camp. With his orders in hand, Amon Goethe confidently planned his sorting process, which he called the Health Action. In one horrible day, he would sentence to death as many prisoners as Oskar Schindler was keeping safe at DEF. The Health Action on Sunday the 7th of May was organized a bit like a county fair. The square was hung with signs that said, "To every prisoner, appropriate work." Loudspeakers played popular music,
And at a long table sat the eccentric Dr. Blank, Dr. Leon Gross, and a number of clerks. The SS doctors assessed the entire prison population by having the prisoners remove all their clothes and run up and down in front of the table. While the music played, the doctors looked for signs of disease and injury, and the clerks recorded the names of the people the doctors judged to be too weak to work, including the children. The prisoners were running for their lives, with their stomachs turning and their lungs fighting for air. Fortunately, many of the camp children survived the health action by hiding on that terrible day. Several hid silently in the ceiling of a barracks, not moving to get food or water or to go to the toilet for hours. The guards avoided the ceilings because they believed the rats that lived up there carried disease. One fairly tall 13-year-old orphan had usually passed as a man, but without his clothes it was obvious that he was still a child, so he was marked down to go to Auschwitz. The boy had to join the children who were leaving the camp. But after a few minutes, he quietly moved away from the group and stood with the safe adults. After another minute or two, he held his stomach and asked the guard for permission to go to the toilet huts. Arriving at the huts, the boy climbed into a toilet hole and found a place to put his feet on either side of the hole. The smell blinded him, and flies crawled into his mouth, ears, and nose. Then he thought he heard ghosts.
"Did they follow you?" whispered a young voice. "This is our place. There isn't room for you," said another.
There were 10 children in there with him. At the end of the process, 1,402 adults and 68 children stood in the square, ready to be transferred to the gas chambers of Auschwitz. Gert considered the figures disappointing, but they made enough room for Plaschow to receive quite a large number of Hungarian prisoners. One hot afternoon, soon after the health action, Schindler and the other factory owners were called to a meeting at the commandant's office. Amon Gert spent the entire time warning them that there were Poles in Warsaw who were planning to attack the camp and release the prisoners. Oscar knew that no such thing would ever happen, and could tell that Amon Gert had a secret motive in telling him and the other owners this ridiculous story, but he was not sure what it was. After the meeting, Oscar gave Gert some beautiful handmade leather riding equipment. Because the fees for his workers now went straight to Berlin, Oscar understood that regular gifts for Gert were necessary to keep him friendly. As the two men drove through the camp to the commandant's house, they could see that the boxcars standing on the railway tracks were full of prisoners, and they could hear the sound of suffering from inside. Oscar stopped his car and listened. Gert, who was feeling very happy with his gift, smiled at his emotional friend.
"Some of them are from Plaschow," said Gert, "and some from the Montelupich prison. They're complaining now. They don't know what suffering is yet."
The roofs of the boxcars were burning hot in the afternoon sun.
"Commandant, if you don't object, I'll call out your fire department," Oscar said.
For some reason, Gert decided to sit back and watch what Schindler might do. When the firemen arrived, Oscar instructed them to turn the water onto the boxcars and cool them down. Then he opened the doors and passed buckets of water inside and had the prisoners pass out any dead bodies. Before the train left the station, he gave the driver a basket of cigarettes, wine, cheese and sausage, and asked him to open the doors when the train stopped near stations and to give the prisoners water. Gert was entertained by Oscar's performance, but he was also worried about him. Schindler's need to help the Jews had reached a new, passionate level, and his actions were becoming more and more dangerous. After the train left, Gert said,
"You have to relax, my friend. You can't go running after every train that leaves this place. You can't change their final destination."
Others, including the prisoner Adam Gard,
also noticed that Schindler's need to stop the madness going on around him became more and more desperate. On the night of the 20th of June, an SS man came to guards' barracks.
"Herr Schindler has called the guardhouse," the man told guard. "It is necessary for you to go to his office immediately."
Guard found Oscar listening to a German radio station with a bottle and two glasses on the table in front of him. He pointed to a chair and a glass of whiskey for guard as he concentrated on what the announcer was saying. Finally, he turned to the young Jew and said, "Someone has tried to kill Hitler. They announced it earlier this evening, and then said that Hitler had survived and would soon speak to the German people. But that was hours ago, and they haven't produced him yet."
"What do you think it means?" asked guard.
"I think he might be dead," said Oscar, with hope rising in his voice. "Just think, it could be the end of the SS, the end of people like Himmler and the death camps." The 10 o'clock news repeated the earlier story, but still Hitler did not speak.
"Our troubles are over," Oscar said. "The world is sane again. Germany can join the Western powers and defeat the Russians."
Guard began to hope that Oscar was right, but all he wished for was a safe place, even an old-fashioned ghetto for the Polish Jews. The same message was repeated every hour as the two men sat together drinking whiskey and hoping. But a little before 1 o'clock in the morning, Hitler began broadcasting from Rastenburg.
"My fellow Germans," the voice began, "I am unhurt and well."
The speech ended 4 minutes later with Hitler's promise to punish those who had tried to murder him. Guard had never really believed that the world would be different in the morning, but Oscar had, and now he was filled with grief.
"Our vision of liberation will have to wait," he said, as if they were both prisoners waiting to be released. Guard was surprised to see how depressed Schindler now looked. Until lately, he had always seemed so practical and optimistic.
Later that summer, Oscar found out the real purpose of Goethe's last meeting with the factory owners. The commandant had heard a rumor that Plaschow and the other labor camps would soon be closed, so he went to the SS police chief in Krakow and told him the story of a possible attack by Poles from Warsaw.
"If there's trouble at Plaschow," Goethe said to the police chief, "do I have your permission to shoot first and do the paperwork later?"
Since General Pohl had been in charge of the camps, Goethe had not been allowed to kill prisoners without a genuine reason. If he ignored the rules from Berlin, he would get into trouble.
"No problem," said the police chief, who was also unhappy with so many new orders from Berlin. "If you're careful and use your judgment, I'll support you."
Goethe now had an excuse to murder some of the prisoners at Plaschow who knew too much about him. Unfortunately for them, the whole Chilowitz family fell into this category. From the first days at Plaschow, they had made themselves useful to Goethe as his agents. They travelled between Plaschow and Krakow, doing business for the commandant, selling food that was meant for the prisoners, as well as jewellery and gold that had been found in the prisoners' clothes or hidden around the camp. They had enjoyed a privileged life. But Goethe believed that the Chilowitzes would try to trade information about him if they needed a way out of a death camp. A very fat Goethe, yellow with disease and having difficulty breathing by this time, had the whole family shot, and then conveniently found a gun hidden in the father's boot. The gun was Goethe's proof that the Chilowitzes had been trying to escape from the camp. When the bodies were displayed on the Plaschow Square, they had signs tied around their chests, which read, "Those who break fair laws can expect a similar death." That, of course, was not the lesson the prisoners learned from the sight. The rumour that Amon Goethe had heard earlier in the summer was confirmed one morning when Oskar Schindler found orders from Army High Command waiting for him on his desk. Because of the war situation, the concentration camp at Plaschow and the sub-camp beside DEF would close. prisoners from DEF would be sent back to Plaszow to wait for the time when all the prisoners would be sent to another camp. Oscar's job, according to the orders, was to close his factory as quickly as possible. Who were these people in Berlin who knew nothing about his Jews? Why didn't they name the camp that the prisoners would be moved to? At least, thought Oscar, people like General Frank, one of the top Nazis in Poland, had had the courage to tell the truth earlier in the year when he said in a speech, "When we finally win this war, Poles, Ukrainians, and all those prisoners idling about here can be cut up and made into dog food." The bosses in Berlin wrote about another camp, and then believed they had no part in the final solution. Goethe, on the other hand, knew exactly what another camp meant, and during Oscar's next visit he told him,
"All Plaszow men will be sent to Gross Rosen and will be worked to death in the vast mine in Lower Silesia. The women will go to Auschwitz, where the death machines are more direct and modern."
When the news that DEF would be closed reached the factory floor and the subcamp, many prisoners believed that they had reached the end of the road. They had had a few years of comparative rest, soup, and sane treatment under Schindler, but they expected to die now. Rabbi Levertov feared facing Amon Goethe again. Edith Liebgold, who had been hired by Bankia for the night shift 3 years before, noticed that Herr Schindler no longer made promises of safety. But at the end of the summer, when the DEF workers packed their bundles and were marched back to Plaszow, there was a rumor among them that Schindler had spoken of buying them back. Some refused to hope that the rumor could be true, but others began to believe that Schindler would get them out again. They began to believe that a list already existed, and surely their names were on it. These Jews, it seems, knew Oskar Schindler very well, because he began talking to Amon Goethe about taking Jews away from Krakow one night as the two men sat alone in Goethe's living room. The commandant was not hosting so many parties these days because Dr. Blank had warned him that if he did not eat and drink less, he would die. Towards the end of a pleasant evening, Oscar began to talk more seriously.
"Commandant, I want to move my factory and my skilled workers to Czechoslovakia, near my home in Zwittau. I'll ask the appropriate office in Berlin for approval, and I'd be very grateful for any support you can give me."
Goethe was always interested when Oscar talked about being grateful, and said,
"Yes, of course. If you can get Berlin to cooperate with your crazy scheme, I'll allow you to make a list of the workers you want from here."
With business out of the way, Goethe wanted a game of cards. He knew that he would profit from helping Oscar with his plan, so now he did not mind risking some money on cards. They played a game that was not easy to lose on purpose, and Oscar kept winning. Soon he had a pile of money in front of him, and Goethe called for Helen Hirsch to bring coffee. The servant came in, looking very clean and neat, but with a swollen and bruised eye. Oscar observed to himself that she was so small that Goethe must have had to bend down to beat her. It was almost a year since Oscar had promised to help Helen. He was always kind when she saw him at the house, but she could not let herself hope that she would escape from Goethe. Only a few weeks before, for example, when the soup was not the correct temperature, the commandant had called for two of his guards and told them to take Helen outside and shoot her. As they marched her to a tree outside Goethe's window, Helen said to one of the men,
"Peter, who is this you're going to shoot? It's Helen, who gives you cakes."
"I know Helen," Peter whispered. "I don't want to hurt you, but if I don't shoot you, he'll kill me and then you."
Helen's legs were trembling violently as the men stood her against the tree. Then, at the last moment, they heard Goethe shouting,
"Bring her back! There's plenty of time to shoot her. Maybe I can still educate her."
After their coffee, Oscar suggested a change in the betting. "I'll need a housekeeper when I return to Czechoslovakia.
It would be very difficult to find a servant as intelligent and well-trained as Helen Hirsch. Let's play one more game, and if you win, I'll pay you double the amount on the table. But if I win, then you give me Helen Hirsch for my list.
Let me think about that, said Gert.
Come on, encouraged Oscar. She's going to Auschwitz anyway.
Oscar tried to keep the tone of the conversation light, but he got up and found some official-looking paper and wrote,
By my authority, the name of Helen Hirsch should be added to any list of skilled workers to be moved to Herr Oskar Schindler's factory in Zwittau. The card game did not last long. Oscar's luck continued, and soon an angry Amon Gert signed the paper Oscar had prepared. Out in her kitchen, Helen Hirsch had no idea that she had been saved over cards. But Schindler later talked about his evening with the commandant to Itzhak Stern, and soon rumours of Oscar's plans spread through Plaschow. There was a Schindler list, and it was worth everything to be on it.